Mini episode 325 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 325. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. I have to tell you that I don't know if 325 is necessarily considered a milestone number, but we have a milestone guest joining us today for a conversation. Ever since we instituted the FDH Lounge as a spinoff from our FantasyDraftHelp.com fantasy sports division in 2007, we've tried to have great conversations with a number of folks and to cover as many topics as possible to be hopefully the widest ranging program that you will find anywhere. Hence our motto, nothing is off topic. We've had on a number of CBS colleagues from this gentleman previously. Now some of these, many of these actually are past colleagues, but Bob Barker four times, Ian Eagle, Charlie Casserly, Rebecca Jarvis, Russ Mitchell, Armin Katayan. You could even say Peter Scolari, Newhart back in the 80s. That was on CBS. Ernie Johnson does a little bit of moonlighting on CBS. So not our first time talking to somebody from the network, but truly one of our most distinguished guests that we've ever been able to have a conversation with. He has been the host of CBS News Sunday Morning since 1994. The show won its first daytime Emmy this year for Outstanding Morning Program. His accolades are too numerous to mention. Here's just a few. Broadcast Hall of Fame, Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame, four Emmy Awards, three Peabody Awards, Marconi Radio Award. He's been with CBS News for 42 years. His Osgood File daily commentaries have been syndicated nationally on the radio by CBS since then, and they can also be found online, just like this program, at osgoodfile.com. So there is a new media component to this gentleman's work, as well as all of the traditional media at CBS News. Again, a true pleasure, and we're very happy that he made time for us today and very grateful. We welcome to the program the one and only Charles Osgood.
I mean, I have been doing this broadcast now for 19 years, and I'll pass people on the sidewalk, and they'll say, look, there's Charles Corral. we share the same first name. But but Charles died many years ago, sad to say, and he retired before he lived for several more years. But he and I had the one requirement that so far has been set down by CBS News, that whoever hosts Sunday Morning has got to be named Charles. That's
going to make the succession process well down the road.
I've actually caught up with Charles because he did the broadcast for the first 20 years, and I'm now 19. Plus, doing Sunday Morning. I'm a year older than I've always been a year older than he was.
Yeah.
So it was the most unexpected thing. I never thought. Well, I remember getting dressed early in the morning, as I always have done to do the morning radio shows, the Osgood File thing that I do on CBS Radio Network, and I was listening to try to catch up on what went on overnight, and I hear that Charles Corral has retired. He's going to retire, and I remember thinking, this is dreadful. This is one of the worst things I ever heard, because the man was really a genius, and I'm honored to get to succeed him. But as I said at the time, there's no way that I was going to be able to replace him. But nobody suggested to me that I would be the one that they would go to, especially since. You know, usually when somebody retires, they get somebody younger to take his place. They don't get somebody older. but anyway, he is. I admired him and learned tremendously from him, and I knew that I would really miss him a lot. But then, as things turned out, I had been on the broadcast enough. I think he had sort of voted that I would be a good successor for him, and it's really. It's been the best you know, I've been around for a long time. I'm 80 years old now, but I've never had a gig that gave me as much satisfaction as doing Sunday morning. Although I have to say that overall, I think radio is a more visual medium than television.
It is something that brings its own set of joys to people, and as far as how it can be consumed and consumed in cars as people are making their way about, and it's very you're right, it's very intimate in that regard. As far as the program itself, from anybody from the outside looking in, it was kind of, I think, easy to see why they would go with you in that role, because you both had that great kind of laid back style that's perfect for the time slot. You know, stylistically, you seem to fit in very well with what he was doing there. But there's this adage in life that you don't want to be the man who follows the man. You want to be the man who follows the man who follows the man. Going back to Bear Bryant and some of the other folks out there, but that's not been a problem for you. The program has not skipped a beat since 1994, so that has to be very gratifying to come in after the guy who laid the groundwork, who made it what it was, and to keep it running at a high level.
Well, I think part of it is because I learned a lot from him. His idea about the way you talk to an audience and the way you tell a story and what you're there for and what your relationship should be. I don't try to copy Charles, because he had a very, very special, unique style all of his own. And if you try to imitate somebody, people can tell right away, oh, he's just trying to talk like Carl does. But it's the concept, you know, it's the way that you think of what you're doing and your relationship with the audience, that I think I try to maintain that same kind of feeling about it, never to talk down to anybody, always to appreciate that there's a good chance that that person watching you or listening to you is smarter than you are. So don't make him think that you're talking down to him ever.
Well, it has been tremendous continuity in that way between what you were doing and what Charles Carroll was doing previously. But it's very interesting, as we mentioned his name, because CBS, it seems to me, and I think probably to most people, in terms of being the Tiffany Network, one of the things that's really set it apart even from ABC and NBC has been the celebration of the lineage and the legacy of everything that's happened there. And I look at, again, and I know that some of the names, if not all of these, are gentlemen. They're a little bit older than you, but all at least generally of your generation, you've been there with such greats as not only Charles Carroll, but Bob Schieffer still presently, Charlie Rose, Harry Reasoner, Mike Wallace. And if you look at other divisions over time, the aforementioned Bob Barker, Pat Summerall. Do you ever kind of reflect on the fact that, again, that you're one of the guys that's still kind of holding the torch for that group there, and that really kind of stands for the broadcast lineage over the decades at CBS News?
Well, I had admired a lot of these guys before I ever got to know them. And I was in my 40s when I started at CBS News. And it really is, I felt a little thrill every time I would just walk down the hall and Walter Cronkite would be coming the other way. And I'd say hello, Charles. And I'd say hello, Walter. And I'd think, holy moly, we're colleagues. Walter Cronkite and I are colleagues. and it turned out, as the years passed, we got to be friends. We played tennis like three times a week together, and until he couldn't play anymore. Now I can't play anymore, so we all headed the same way. But he is certainly another model of mine, and I think that he's somebody who always kept the audience in mind, and also wanted to make sure that the audience knew that he had that respect for them. And also was trying to, he never told you things as if, I've known this all along, just as I thought, you know, this is, you don't preach to them. What you do is to say, here is what I just found out. You know, it's not that you're a know-it-all, it's just something that you happen to be in a position, because you're standing there where the news is kind of flowing in, and you're able to say, this is just what I just found out, and this is interesting, I think. And then you talk to them in that way. And that's one thing that Walter would never sort of depart from his persona as. I mean, he was a wonderful guy and made it, you know, as a colleague and as a friend. But the audience he always addressed the audience with respect, and I think that's number one, and especially on a Sunday morning when your audience is probably still in their bathrobes and slippers and they're tuning in while having a second cup of coffee, and they're not on their way somewhere. They're home, and they're some of them are even still in bed. You know, if you get up at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, turn the TV set on, and the Sunday morning feeling is there, and we try to put it into that feeling into the broadcast as well.
Absolutely, it really does sort of personify the atmosphere of Sunday morning itself, and again, I think that's why it's been so successful over a period of time. And like you said, speaking to folks with respect and not talking down to them, which I know is a commonplace criticism of the national media these days, and that folks react poorly to that when they feel that they are being talked down to. That takes me to one of your commentaries from the past week here from the Osgood File, vis-a-vis the government shutdown and the headlines of the moment, everything we're dealing with, potentially, hopefully not, a debt default looming as well. And you did a very good job of capturing, I thought, just the general sense of frustration that people are feeling right now, because pretty much across the spectrum, it would seem that folks are not happy with what's going on, regardless of where your sympathies lie. And for me personally, it's folks who are ostensibly aligned with my political philosophies that have voted to keep the government shut over this period of time, yet I'm not a very happy person myself. So when you approach something like that and you're trying to get a sense of the general feel of the country and how you would put it into words, how do you approach a subject like that?
Well, first of all, I have a little luxury here because a news item on a news broadcast has to be measured in seconds. You don't get to devote a lot of time. I've got a broadcast that's a 3-minute broadcast. Some of that is commercials, but I'm allowed to talk at greater length and try to take a wider viewpoint on it and try to see it the way and express the way I'm feeling and put it in that context so that the audience. I do not want to be identified as a Republican or a Democrat, as a liberal or a conservative. I think there's sometimes I feel like one, and sometimes I feel like the other, and I don't want people to pigeonhole me as to how I'm going to take in any particular issue. So I don't. This is not about whether we should or shouldn't extend the debt limit, or whether we should or should not raise taxes or increase government services to the point where we have no way to pay for. I mean, there's a measure of truth in both sides of this argument. I listen to what they say. Some of it makes sense, but here's what doesn't make sense. This is a story out of my own background. When I was in the Army, I was in the United States Army Band. How I got that job is another story. But in that job, one of the things that I would do is I announced the concerts that they gave in Washington and did some recruiting broadcasts that they did on radio. And one of my jobs was to work with there's a fellow who is one of the top arrangers. He was a composer for the Army Band, and he wrote some things, marches that had a trio section. The trio section is something that would be sung by the chorus. And we had done a thing called Gallant Men, which was, this is the Army Band, so it's about, this is Gallant Men refers to people who fought in the wars that this country has fought in. And years later, I did the lyric for the trio section. And years later, I was actually, it was before I started at CBS, though, I was working for ABC Radio for a show that they had called Flair Reports. I was working with Ted Koppel, among others. And the subject came up. Does anybody here, one of the writers said, does anybody here know Everett Dirksen? Because I think it would be a great idea for a record to have Everett Dirksen read some of the speeches and well-written pieces of literature that are in American history, things like the Gettysburg Address and the preamble to the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and have Dirksen read these things, because he had a wonderfully mellifluous kind of a voice, and he was sort of a character. I mean, he used to give a speech every year in the Senate trying to make the marigold the national flower, and things like that. He had a sort of flowery style. But anyway, I think Ron Cochran was a friend of mine who was also at ABC there at the time, and he knew Dirksen. So I asked him if he would call and find out whether Dirksen had would consider making a record. And he said, well, he believed that he was still that he had agreed to do a record for RCA. But he said he didn't know where that stood, but yes, he would like to do that. And in fact, he said that he thought that the thing that they wanted him to do was what he called Peter and the Rabbit. So we had heard of Peter and the Wolf, and we had heard of Peter Rabbit, but we'd never heard of Peter and the Rabbit. But anyway, he said he would check it out. And then he called back and said, yes, no, I think it sounds like a very good idea. So then the next step was, who knows how to make a record? And I called my friend John Kakavas, who at that point was already, he was doing the music for TV shows and for movies and things like that. So I said, well, do you have any ideas about how should we go about this? And he said, well, first of all, he has got to record our song, Gallant Man. He said it would be perfect for him. And so we actually made the record. I made the record. And we had an orchestra, and we had a chorus to sing this thing, and Everett McKinley Dirksen narrated Gallant Men. Now, this was during the Vietnam War, but it was not about Vietnam, because we had written it way before, the Korean War was just about, was barely over when we wrote that. But he made it, it became a hit. And that record actually got to be like number five in the whole country at that time. And they were playing it. I mean, pop stations weren't likely to play a patriotic march, but especially, one narrated by the majority leader of the United States Senate. But anyway, I got to know him. We worked together on this record, and I found out that he sort of took turns as majority leader or minority leader, depending on whether the Democrats or Republicans were in control of the Senate. And the guy that he alternated with was Lyndon Johnson. And whether Johnson was majority leader or Dirksen was majority leader, at the end of every single day, and they took opposite sides on a lot of issues because Johnson was a Democrat and Dirksen was a Republican. So they had, philosophically, they were poles apart. But every day, they would go into the office of the majority leader where there was a bar. And they would pour themselves a couple of stiff bourbons, and they would sit there and talk about what had happened during the day, and how they could, what's on your mind? What's important to you to get through? I got to get through this bill on, the labor bill or whatever the heck it was. And they'd say, he said, but I need three votes. I need three of your votes. And he'd say, well, yeah, I think I could do that, but I got something I need for you to do. I want to get this thing through. There's a farm bill, whatever the heck it was. And at the end of the day, they horse traded, in order to get something done. But can you imagine, today's majority and minority leaders in the Senate or elsewhere in the leadership of Congress, in the House or the Senate, having a drink at the end of the day so that they could figure out how they would get something done? I mean, they've been demonizing each other all day long. So you don't solve that problem by having a drink occasionally at the end of the day. But these guys, it was not occasionally. They did it every single working session of every daily session of Congress, and they did get stuff done. And Johnson went on to become president of the United States, and Dirksen was a little older, a little too old. He said the ship has already left the dock, so he was not going to run for president. But he enjoyed being, he was on Johnny Carson's show. He was on being interviewed. In fact, Roger Mudd interviewed him about it on the CBS Evening News, and he had been a balloonist in the war and had very, very fascinating sort of a background. As I say, he was a character. But anyway, what I learned from that thing was that it's possible for Democrats and Republicans to work together, and they did work together, and the leadership really led them. It was possible for them to go to people in their own party and say, we need this because we need that. I mean, so we can do this because then they'll get their cooperation the next time, and we'll get things done. And I think that it's the sort of toxic attitude that Congress has, And I think it's not just there. I mean, I think listen to people, you know, commentary on the radio. They're pretty consistently, you know, one way or the other. You get a lot of conservatives listening to Rush Limbaugh, and you get a lot of liberals listening to somebody else. I just think you have to be able to willing to listen to voices other than your own. That's what I'm saying.
No, that's absolutely right. And again, I'm somebody who, I have my own ideology that I believe in, but I read things across the spectrum, if only to get a sense of what other people are thinking and what some of the counter arguments are. And you are absolutely right that that's a healthy thing for people to do. As far as Everett Dirksen goes, that's a wonderful summation of a lot of things about the man and what he did. And one of the things that comes to my mind, I believe he was the author of the quote, "Was he not $1 billion here and $1 billion there?" You're talking about real money.
Yes, he did.
I think that was him.
But he had this kind of way. He had a sort of voice that was sort of like this. He had emphysema, and it was necessary for him to take a rather deep breath between every phrase. But he worked with it so that it sounded like, you know, you were listening to, and he looked like a senator. He looked like a sort of cartoon senator. You know, had sort of white, mm-hmm. white flowing hair, and he had this this voice. But he was a decent person, and I was very surprised to find out that even though they disagreed about a lot of things, that they felt it was their responsibility to help all the people. And I think presidents have to be the same way too. And Johnson, when he got to be president, they called him the master of the Senate, which he was, but he achieved that mastery partly by getting along with Dirksen, and getting him to, you know, appealing to his better instincts to try to do what's best for the country. And I think Johnson was able to do the same thing, you know, with the civil rights bill. That Kennedy had a lot of trouble trying to get a civil rights bill through, and Johnson was able to do it partly through those same skills that he had of working with other people and giving them a sense of you know, we're going to arrive at something here that's going to be good for everybody, and they can do it. They really can do it. But you know, just look at the way people campaign now. You have somebody tell you what to say and what not to say, and they try to put their fingers in the air and find out which way the wind is blowing before they open their mouths and say what they think. They're supposed to be leaders. They're supposed to tell people, to explain to people why they take the positions that they do, and hope that the people will understand what they're doing, and hopefully vote for them again if they have enough respect for them. But it's the idea of thinking that this person that's running against me is the biggest son of a bitch who ever lived. That's the message that you get from every time you hear a politician talking about his opponent now, because that's what you're supposed to do. It's supposed to be like a battle to the death. But I think that we gotta do something about that. We have to have get away from the negative politics that seems to have in sway right now.
It is incredibly pervasive in our politics these days. No question about that, and it's very interesting, as you mentioned, battle to the death. You perfectly anticipated, although you couldn't have known it, my next question I wanted to ask you about, and that being, again, in terms of recent Osgood file commentaries, again, I thought you did a very good job memorializing the life of Tom Clancy, of whom I was a fan. And
yes.
Again, your approach on something like that, when someone of that nature passes away with their level of magnitude, and you know that you're going to be tasked with trying to put it into perspective, how do the thoughts kind of go through your head in building one of your commentaries?
Well, I think what we are all doing the same thing. I mean, I know that you have been you've focused a lot on sports, but I love sports. I love talking about it. My son and I talk about sports practically every morning at the breakfast table. He also is a
mm-hmm.
He's involved in a show that's sort of like yours in a way. I mean, it's a blogcast, and
mm-hmm.
He loves to listen to other people's points of view. And both, I mean, what, you know, what we're all doing, we're all storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
That includes that's from Scott Pelley on down at CBS. We what do we call these items that that either you read in the paper or that you hear on the radio or see on television? We call them stories. How many stories are going to get in tonight? Well, that's what you know, that they're stories. But if you say, well, you know what you are, Scott Pelley, you are a storyteller. I mean, he would say, well, yes, we call them stories, but we just are reporting the facts and telling people what, you know, what's going on. But I think we are storytellers. And by the way, I'm on radio anyway. I also do advertising. That was sort of grandfathered in because it was in my contract to begin with. And I have a, sort of a license to, it's a 007 kind of license I'm the only person that does news show for CBS that they allow to do commercials on radio because.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going out to Chicago this week, and we're going to be talking to a luncheon of the advertising agency that handles a couple of our accounts that is the sponsor of the Osgood file. And what I'm going to tell them is that you know, advertising is storytelling. You want to take a good look at your client, find out who they are, who are the characters in this, what is their character, and what do they stand for? What is it that they can do for you? So in other words, you are trying to identify characters. What do you have in a story? You have characters, whether it's a movie or a play or a novel or whatever it is. You are writing about and talking about the human relations. You're talking about the relationship between a company and its customers, a company and its employees. The employees, no matter what they do, you're in sales, you're in finance, you're in whatever it is. These stories are all much better told if you can tell them in human terms. And so that's what we try to do.
Absolutely, and that is the essence of it. And there are so many of them that come up that are memorable as you look back at the lineage of CBS News Sunday Morning. And again, you're going to have the 35th anniversary, of course, of that show. Coming up next year, so that's going to be a real focal point as you're trying to go back and summarize some of the things that have happened. What are some of the stories that come up the most that people really remember?
Kowalt was not in good health when he died. He had lupus,
mm-hmm.
And he would tire very, very easily. And I think that the lupus had not even been diagnosed at the time that until very just before he died. And I think that what people liked about him is that he seemed like somebody that you would like to have dinner with, you know, or drink with, and he would be good company, and I think that's what you want to do if you're going to be stopping in somebody's living room on a Sunday morning. You want to be reasonably jovial, and you don't want to yell at them. That's another thing we do too much of in television, it seems to me, is you know, and we think we're trying to convince people that we're right about something that, you know, we believe to be true, but even so, you have to be gentlemanly about it. Charles was a consummate gentleman, and I've tried to remember that in the way I deport myself on television and radio too.
Absolutely, and that is very. Very important. Just in bringing us full circle and taking a look at the future and where things are going, we've had a number of discussions on this program with a number of broadcast and technology folks about the move towards a more on-demand medium, particularly as television and the internet are becoming merged with smart TVs. And it seems, at least on the surface, that the success that CBS has had is one of the biggest things that's kind of holding up that development, that CBS, with their highly rated programs, we still are in an era of appointment viewing. NBC, I think, would like us to be at the point of on-demand at any point in time now, because their primetime lineup hasn't had too many shows that have been appointment viewing in recent years. But CBS still has that. Do you have any kind of a sense, as you're talking to some of the advertisers and you're talking to any of the folks that you deal with, exactly where on the continuum that we may be in terms of how much longer we have of 9 a.m. Sunday morning, this is when we want people to watch this, as opposed to, hey, hopefully folks will download this at some point Sunday?
Yeah, I would not like to have Leslie Moonves' job, you know, because he's very, very good at it. But I have no idea what people are going to like and what they're going to respond to, and what shows are likely to catch on with the public. I wouldn't be very good at that at all. So. But I think he has been very good at it. And they've had a succession of people who seem to have some instinct as to what people would want to watch. And I have a lot of respect for the people who do that, but I'm really glad that I'm not the one that gets to decide about what other shows that are ought to be on. Sunday morning, in fact, we in a lot of markets, and in most of the big ones, we precede Face the Nation's broadcast that the Bob Schieffer does, and we deliver them, you know, the top-rated show. I mean, there are more people already tuned to CBS by the time that show comes on, and so we've helped them to become the top of the top sort of political news broadcast that there is on Sunday morning. That's what mainly we had on Sunday mornings. CBS had a religious show originally. They had two religious shows. There was a woman named Pamela Hylott who was a very good producer, and she made these stories interesting and would have panel discussions and then pieces that you'd go out and do about something that was being done under the in the world of religion. But the decision was made to bring in Shad Northfield, who had done white papers on NBC, and I think that Shad Northfield was the one who really thought of the idea of doing what he called a Sunday newspaper on television. But it would be, of course, in television terms. You know, we're not newspapers suspended in space, so you can increase the space by adding pages or by adding sections to the newspaper. But our show is an hour and a half. And that's a fixed amount of time. You cannot add to it. But you can. But that's a longer time to devote to the subjects than you have during the week. And the audience is sitting down. They're not standing up in the doorway and turning around halfway through your sentence and walking out of the room, which is, I'm sure, what goes on during the week, because people are on their way to work. They're on their way to school. They're or getting the kids to school, or packing their lunches, or whatever grown-up people have to do when it's a school day, work day. But I think Sunday morning he saw that as an opportunity to do pieces about nature and pieces about science and to find people who would be good at telling those stories so that they could be understood. You know, don't use the lingo and don't try not to fall into that. Habit, which a lot of us do, of just using all the initials, you know, that are around, and I think that's one of our secrets is that we try to talk to the audience in English.
It's a lost art, it really is. But you guys do a tremendous job at it, and you're great at being able to let stories just kind of breathe a little bit, which we're not used to seeing as much on broadcast television, and that's what's helped make it an institution. And again, going on its 35th year next year, and I look forward to all the celebrations that are going to be surrounding that.
Well, thank you for giving me the time to answer these questions. You're a very good listener yourself, which is the key to being a good interviewer.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. We just try to have good conversations on this program, very enlightening for the listeners, and I would defy anybody to tell me that they don't come away from this enlightened, getting to hear about what we've discussed today. And as such, I'd love to have you back sometime, sir. It was a true pleasure to get to do this with you.
Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
All right, thank you very much, Charles. All right, we appreciate you all tuning in, everybody, today. FDH Lounge, mini episode number 325. With the great Charles Osgood.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.